The 9th of October, 8 weeks lying ahead of us before we say goodbye to 2018 in Parliament. A lot of work is still waiting outside. Welcome to members of the committee. Welcome also, special welcome to our chairs of finance in the provincial legislators. And I'm going to give the opportunity to them that they introduce themselves. On my left hand side,
morning, Chairperson, morning. Honourable members. I am Sipho KK Nkosi from KwaZulu-Natal.
KZN, fantastic.
Morning, Chair, honourable members, and everybody. I'm Pumelelo Sasua, Chair, Eastern Cape, KZN, our neighbour.
Eastern Cape, brilliant. Welcome.
Morning, everybody. My name is Mpapa Kanyani, also from Gauteng Legislature, and I'm standing for the Chairperson of Finance Portfolio Committee.
Welcome from Gauteng. Limpopo.
Dixon Masemola, Chair Limpopo Legislature.
Welcome.
Natwata Sambata, I'm serving in the Committee of Finance Northwest. I'm standing in for the Chair. Who's that available?
Welcome from the Northwest.
Morning, Chair.
Morning.
I'm Fidel Mlombo. I'm the Chairperson of Finance from Mpumalanga.
Mpumalanga, where the sun rises.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, everybody. I am Tiny Chotelo, member of the Portfolio Committee of Finance, and I'm standing in for the Chairperson. And I'm proud to be the only woman amongst men. Thank you so much, Chair.
We note you from the Northern Cape. All the way from the biggest province in South Africa, Northern Cape, with 1.2 million people. Yeah, that's the reality. We're working here with realities in finance. So welcome to everyone, also welcome to the staff, and then welcome to Advocate Jenkins. That will take us through clause by clause. That was the decision we took at our previous meeting, where we had a quick briefing on the bill. And then also, welcome to Dr. Dumasani Yankees from the Parliamentary Budget Office. There he sits. We'll see his face a lot for the next 8 weeks in finance and the preparations as we go into the 24th of October when the MTBBS will be tabled. Also to our colleagues from the provinces, Finance committees, you'll get your invitation between today and Friday, inviting you to the lock-up session on the 24th of October, the morning 10 o'clock until 1:45, afternoon the tabling by the Minister of Finance, the MTBBS, and the 25th, the first day, the briefing by the Honourable Minister of Finance on the MTBBS, 12:30 until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But that schedule you will receive by email. Apologies, Secretary.
Thanks, Chair. Apologies, Mr. Mutara, Mr. Isaac, and Mr. Demande.
All the members, there's three apologies. Can we table the apologies? Are there someone to move the adoption? Honorable Kayla moves for adoption.
Move for the adoption.
Person to second. Where's my friend? What's that shooting? No second. Apologies with three. Moved for adoption that we adopt the apologies. Isaac, Matara, and Samandi. The three honorable members. That's it. Thank you. That is covered. And welcome also to our committee secretary. He was in hospital, but he looks very fine and fit. Thank you, Solani, for assisting us in this meeting. Honourable members, you've got the bill in front of you. Also, our chairs and our delegates from the provincial legislators. There's a specific section in the bill that deals with provincial legislators, which Advocate Jenkins will also engage with and which you must take serious note of. We are scheduled to have public hearings from 2 o'clock until 4 o'clock, as was advertised in the media. Here's the advertisement that was in all media, so the country knows what we are doing today. There was only 2 submissions, and the wording of the 2 submissions is 90% the same. You can see the people work together, although it's 2 different individuals. That was circulated also, and Advocate Jenkins can maybe after the presentations and questions just deal with that. But that we are back here 2 o'clock as indicated in our advertisement. If no one turns up at 2 o'clock, that's it. But we can't stay away because the public was informed. There's a public hearing from 2 until 4. So we will have to be present. Advocate Jenkins, over to you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Good morning. Good morning, Honourable Members. Colleagues, members of the public. Chair, firstly, my apologies for being late. We have this security crackdown, so I have to get searched every time I go through a door, which is good. But I should have started earlier, so my apologies, Chair. Chair, my intention today is just to go through the bill, clause by clause, as requested. I did not make a presentation. I think, and I will take guidance from the committee and from yourself, I think the best would be to have the written bill in front of us and to go through it and to make notes where there are questions and to just explain what are we doing with each and every amendment. And if that's in order, I'm going to start. If it doesn't work out, we can change the system during the, if it's possible. But Chair, to start then on page 2 or page, first page where we have substance and not the front page where it says bill, and you get the long title of the amendment bill. So that just explains to us what we're going to do with this amendment bill. It's not an amendment to the Act itself. The long title of the Act is amended, but that is at the end of this bill, and I'll get there. So let me just, in the interest of time, go past that and get to the amendments we've been starting to make to Section 1 of the Act. And these are amendments to the definitions. The first amendment we have at paragraph A, 1A, is just to, what I would say, clarify and to make the definitions consistent with the way we draft. It's the definition of adjustments appropriation bill, means the bill that provides adjustments to the Appropriation Act, not just to the appropriation. What we see in the square brackets, the bold printed square bracket, is what we're removing, and we are inserting what we are underlining. So that's just then we're changing the definitive article to an indefinite article to give effect to a national adjustment budget and not the national adjustment budget, because there can be more in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. At paragraph B, Chairperson, I would take it that if someone has a question or if I need to stop, I will stop. Someone will tell me to stop. Otherwise, I'll just continue with the next paragraph. Paragraph B, a new definition for advisory board. That is a new definition that we're putting in there. Advisory board means the chairpersons of the committees on finance and appropriations, and then the house chairpersons of the two houses. That is what is happening in practice at the moment. And if it is in order, Chair, I'll deal with the whole issue of advisory board when we get to the amendment to Section 15, which deals with the Parliamentary Budget Office. And with the public submissions we received, the debt comment on those issues. Paragraph C, we are inserting members of Parliament just to clarify where the members, in what context are we referring to members. Paragraph D, we are inserting a definition for department, and this specifically pertains to when we get to 2 areas in the bill. One, the BRRRs, the Budgetary Review and Recommendation Reports, and then also when we're dealing with the strategic objectives of a department that must be submitted at the introduction of the budget. So department means a national department or a national government component as defined in the Public Finance Management Act. Paragraph E, Division of Revenue Bill, the bill that must be introduced in the National Assembly annually in terms of the Constitution and the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act. So it's just a clarification there, it's not a substantive amendment. We're bringing in a new definition of executive authority. That is also to align this Money Bills Amendment Procedure Act to the Financial Management of Parliament and Provincial Legislatures Act. And we have the definition in that act, the Financial Management of Parliament and Provincial Legislatures Act, of executive authority. So we're taking that same definition. It's the Speaker of the National Assembly and the Chairperson of the National Council of Provinces acting jointly. Paragraph G, we're giving a definition of the Financial Management of Parliament and Provincial Legislatures Act. Paragraph H, fiscal framework. Chair, that fiscal framework's amendment is a proposal that was accepted by the Standing Committee that came from the Parliamentary Budget Office. And it's basically just to explain that our fiscal framework covers the MTEF, Medium-Term Expenditure Framework, and we have a definition which I'm coming to. So it is not just a static once-a-year kind of framework. It's a framework that spans over 3 years. Of course, applicable to the year that we are dealing with. But the framework itself spans across. And Chair, that's the other points made indirectly in the public submissions also pertains to that idea or the concept we have of the fiscal framework and the MTEF. How do we deal with it? And it specifically talks to what's the relationship between your adjustments, your medium-term budget policy statement and your adjustments budget. It is not just coincidental that they get introduced at the same time. And there's a fixed relationship between them, which we tried to bring out in the Act, and there was public submissions on that, so I'll deal with that as I come. Those are the two areas in the public submissions that I will deal with. The other area, of course, the advisory board. Okay, the fiscal framework, it's now covering the period of the MTEF, and we're including the revenue proposals there at paragraph A of paragraph H. And one can see the amendments there. The estimated revenue that we're going to raise through the period, not just for the financial year. Estimates, paragraph B, estimates of all expenditure, budgetary and extra budgetary, specified separately for that period. And the same at C. So it's not a new way, it's just reflecting how we in any event deal with the fiscal framework and the adjustments budget. Main division within a vote is a new definition. We're just referring to the Public Finance Management Act. Again, that refers to the BRRRs as well as when we are dealing with certain recommendations from committees that they can make a recommendation on the vote. Paragraph J, we have a definition of MTEF, medium-term expenditure framework, that translates government policies and plans into multi-year spending plan, promotes transparency, accountability, and effective public financial management for the expenditure of the current and subsequent two financial years. So that's now the relationship between the fiscal framework and the MTEF, how we look at it. We're trying to put it into the context which in any event, how it comes to Parliament from National Treasury, as well as how Parliament does its own budgeting, by the way. Clarification of paragraph K, Parliament, not as envisaged, but referred to in section 42 of the Constitution, Chairperson. I have Mr. Michael Prince here. He's in our office, Constitutional Legal Services. He did the drafting. We have a unit within our office that deals specifically with drafting conventions. How do we draft consistently? So if there are questions about this, why do we change envisage to refer to? Envisage, as I understand it, is you have to create it still. It's imagine that we should have a budget office, so we envisage a budget office, but someone must create it. When we refer to something, it's there already, and Section 42 of the Constitution says there is a parliament. So we just clarified that for consistency. Public Finance Management Act, it's a correction we made from the act as it is. Number has been inserted. This act, we've created a definition because now we have regulations, the power to make regulations in terms of this act. So this act would include those regulations that the executive authority may make, specifically when it comes to the reporting of the Parliamentary Budget Office. The chairperson, those are the definitions. We're going to the amendments to the substantive provisions of the Act on page 4, clause 2 of the bill. Clause 2 amends section 3 of the Act. Now, Chair, just to explain why we're doing this, what we're saying here is that this Act applies to all Division of Revenue bills, the NCBPS, fiscal framework, amendments to any of the aforesaid and related instruments brought before Parliament. Our Section 3 was drafted, and one can see we're removing proposed amendments too. Our Section 3 was drafted with that bold that was there, actually says that this Act applies only when we want to make amendments to the budget. But it's a circular argument because if we envisage that we might want to make amendments to the budget, we in any case have to apply the procedure. So what we're doing with Section 3 is just to say, when we're dealing with your money bills, when you're dealing with the budget, this is the procedure to deal with it in terms of the Act. It does not apply only when you want to make amendments. That's why we're taking that proposed amendments out, and we're just saying it applies to all these bills as well as amendments to any of those. Clause 3 of the bill, it's an amendment to Section 4 of the Act. Again, it's more textual, more for clarity. The powers and functions conferred to it by the Constitution or on it, so that's just to get the drafting consistent again. Importantly, though, again, when we want to say what must be done, it's not just amendments to the fiscal framework. It is the fiscal framework, the revised fiscal framework, the bills and amendments there too. It's not just when we amend them, it's also the amendments there too, as well as the bill, even if we don't make any amendments. It must go through the procedure envisaged in this Act. Paragraph B of that clause 3 deals with amendments to subsection 4 of section 4 of the Act. Again, it's just changing the two to an on for clarity, consistency. And then from paragraph B, we're dealing again with, does this apply only to amendments or to the bills, even if we don't do amendments? And that's the reason why we're taking that amendments to out at the beginning, and we're saying it applies to the Division of Revenue Appropriations Bill, Supplementary Appropriation Bills, and amendments there too. So it applies to all the money bills when it comes to Parliament. There was some discussion, I'm looking at paragraph D, the amendments to paragraph D, reports or statements. Now that refers to the language used in the Public Finance Management Act, which says that we must publish monthly reports or statements and put these before Parliament. So, Chair, we just brought that in because there was a question raised in the Standing Committee on this. Section 32 speaks in its heading 32 of the Public Finance Management Act, publishing of reports on the state of the budget. Now, within 30 days after the end of each month, National Treasury must publish in the National Government Gazette a statement on actual revenue and expenditure. So the heading speaks of reports, the substance of the sections in the Public Finance Management Act speaks of statements. So we said reports or statements. We covered them all. We know what we're talking about there. Chair, clause 4 of the bill, on page 4, deals with section 5 of the Act. We're changing the heading. Headings in legislation do not have definite or indefinite articles, so we're taking the out, the out, all of the's and the is history. So we're taking those out, and that's what we're doing with the heading. When we're going to the substance of the provisions here, in section 5, just to refresh members, section 5 of the Act deals with the procedure prior to the introduction of the budget. And that's when you're dealing actually with the annual assessment in terms of the BRRRs. So what we've done with the amendments to Section 5 is just to bring in the latest, I want to say, modern language to these things. So we're changing priorities to goals. And these are, this is the language that's used in the documents of National Treasury, so that we know what we're talking about. Again, we're changing report to report or statements to a vote appropriating funds for, and remember we had the definition for votes. At paragraph E, now that's paragraph E of subsection 5, subsection 1 of section 5, reports of the Standing Committee on Public Accounts. I heard that earlier in the committee, Chair. When we reviewed the rules of the National Assembly, we changed the name of the Committee on Public Accounts to what in practice everybody is referring to them, SCOPA, so the Standing Committee on Public Accounts. So now we've brought that in as consistency with the rules that's been reviewed of Parliament. Page 5 of the bill, we're dealing with paragraph C. That was just a textual amendment, department, plural, it should have been department with an apostrophe S. At paragraph D, we're inserting a review, that was an omission in the Principal Act, budgetary review and recommendation report. And further down in that same section, medium-term budget policy statement was capitalized. We are now doing it in lower cases. Again, at paragraph E of the bill, that means looks at subsection 6 of section 5, budgetary review and recommendation reports. Some of that is omitted from the Principal Act. And then, Chairperson, I hope no one's going to throw oranges at me on this one, but I think this committee agreed with when we said this in the initial briefing when we had a joint meeting. Additional budgetary review and recommendation reports may be submitted at the discretion of a committee of the National Assembly. So we've made that clear. Now, that was a decision that was taken there, and I, as I said, with input of NCOP members that were there, that the budgetary review and recommendation reports pertaining to that specific oversight function of the National Assembly. And committees of the NCOP do not have to do that. So that's the clarity we're giving there. But there was a lot of discussion around this. Should NCOP committees also be required to submit budgetary review and recommendation reports. But because of the constitutional mandate of the NCOP, it is not necessary. Doesn't mean the committee of the NCOP can't express a view or make a report on the performance of a department, especially if you think of the concurrent competencies like water and health. Chairperson, I saw a hand of Mr. Blount. Not.
No, I just wanted to follow up on what I have to say. If I understood you correctly, members of the NCOP may or can make a submission, but that's not necessary, or can we just consider that?
Yes. Sorry, I didn't switch off my mic. No, 100% Chairperson. The mandate of an NCOP, of a select committee or any committee of the NCOP, of course, it's set out in the rules. In terms of those rules, they can make reports to the House. That's not to curtail that power. The discussion when we went through the amendments to Section 5 of the Act was that should there be a requirement, in other words, a peremptory requirement, that there must be an annual assessment of each government department. That's done by the National Assembly at the moment. Should that also extend to the NCOP? The decision that was taken was no, that NCOP do not look at a specific government department like a portfolio committee does. Select committees work in clusters, and they do not do budgetary review and recommendation reports. So when we want to give that authority to a committee to say you can, in addition to your compulsory or peremptory BRRR that you must do annually, you can also during the year submit further BRRRs. Should that, because of the connection between the peremptory one and the additional authority to do more, should that be extended to the NCOP or should it just remain with the National Assembly? And the decision was taken to remain with the National Assembly because of the link between the two. But, as I said, it does not mean that in terms of the rules, a select committee cannot report on the performance of a government department. And certainly they can. because they have a different focus. There's an intergovernmental focus rather than just a national department. So whereas the, I mean, I'm you know it even better than I do, that, sorry.
There are honorable members, select committees that engage with annual reports of departments. So that it's free for them to do it. In terms of the Constitution, if I'm correct, Section 65 of the Constitution. Honorable Motla Shupi?
Chair, well, I concur with the proposal, but then I'm questioning myself in terms of the oversight role that the NCOP has to play on the department. Will it not impact in terms of whatever the CFP cuts in the process?
Chair, it's a very valid point. I mean, if you, from my own experience, if I take, just as in a hypothetical example, Department of Health, that has certain performance issues, again, hypothetically, they can stand in a portfolio committee and say, well, our problem is actually that we are merely an agent. We are just transferring budgets to provinces to deal with infrastructure upgrades and capacitation of health services in provinces. So the fact that we have a health crisis in the country, it's not our problem. We're actually performing well. We did our transfers. Of course, one can go into the details, what is the responsibilities of the transferring accounting officer to the transferer, etc., etc. But in effect, you need that input. And that's the role of the NCOP, as I understand the Constitution, is to then look at the intergovernmental issues to say which provinces are not performing or are hampering the true delivery of health services in terms of the Bill of Rights. So when we looking at the budget, and this is of course what this is about, looking at the budget to say, should Parliament amend health budget, hypothetically speaking? I don't want to be quoted in the media that there's a problem with health at all, but just hypothetically speaking, to use an example, we will need that input. So definitely there needs to be, or let me put it this way, there ideally should be some kind of communication between, say, reports from select committee dealing with these issues to the portfolio committee to say, look, we've got a bigger picture than you are presenting to us today. We know what's happening in the provinces. We've had NCOP doing certain site visits, oversight visits to various areas, and there are problems with how that money is spent, and whether the accounting officer of the national department is aware of it is then the question. And what is that person doing to it? Is the money employed correctly, efficiently and effectively to deal with those issues? Because that's what we want to find out. If it's not, how can we shift the money to achieve the outcomes that we want in terms of delivering the health services? So all this amendment does, because we did go a bit broader, is that it says NCOP does not have to submit a BRRR. It does not say the NCOP cannot look at an annual report of a department, do the site visits, go to provinces and deal with the intergovernmental issues at all. In my personal view, it's very useful to have that intergovernmental perspective when we're dealing with a national department before a portfolio committee. But I'm sure it has happened, but I'm not very aware of, like, we have a system where we look at those intergovernmental things. It depends a lot on the committee and the chairperson to say, look, we want to have a broader view of exactly what's going on here. And specifically the public. I mean, it's the public that will come forward and say, I'm living in Lusikisiki and I'm not getting health services. I'm living up in Mpumalanga and I can't get treatment for malaria, or something like that. Why not? Where is the problem? You know, how is that money transferred in terms of the division of revenue bill to deal with those issues? So that perspective is necessary if you really want to do a proper oversight over a national department that's a transferring department in terms of the concurrent competencies.
I also refer members to Section 69 of the Constitution, page 41. the NCOP or any of its committees may require any institution or person to report to it. Section 69B. There's different subsections. I'm not going to repeat everything. So it allows the institution, the National Council of Provinces, to take that route also. Honourable Terblanche.
Sorry, Chairperson, I don't want to label this point. My question is, I'm not fully covered on this yet. The obvious question that on my side is why...
Sorry, Chairperson. Why should this well, be quieted on, you know, this function that could also be done by the NCOP? Mustn't it make then provision for the exact thing that you explained to us? I'm just asking.
Thank you, Chairperson, if I may. No, correct. Very valid point. But the authority to do that, as the Chairperson quoted, and there's other examples of it also in the rules. Select committees do have the authority already to do that. What we're doing with this legislation is to say when we are getting the budget, when we're having the fiscal framework, when we're having the MTBPS and then all the legislation attached to those, you've got to follow this procedure. So this is a peremptory procedure that we're saying this is how we're going to deal with the budget for various reasons. So we don't want to create additional obligations for the NCOP committees to say, well, you have to do this as well. The NA does it, but you must do it. Because what if they don't do it? Does the budget then fall down? Is it illegally passed because we didn't have a BRRR from the select committee? That is why we're... But we're not taking anything away. I mean, that is there. We just don't have to repeat it in the legislation.
The BRRR project in the NA started this morning. And it's quite a packed program, that I can assure you. Thank you. Proceed, Advocate Chair.
Thank you, Chair. We're moving now on. We're still on page 5, amendment of Section 6 of the Money Bills Act. Chair, here it's more or less just consequential amendments to the definition of fiscal framework. If you're looking at Section 6 of the Act, it deals with the MTBPS. So subsection 2, which we're amending there, is the items that must be included in the MTBPS, which you will receive shortly, on the 24th, I think the Chairperson said. So we, instead of just looking at the present financial year in which the statement is stable, we're again looking at the frameworks of the next three financial years. And we spoke about, mentioned that earlier when we dealt with the definition of fiscal framework. And that is finds its way throughout the provisions. In C, in D, we are removing and between arms of government within a sphere. I think the bottom line there is there's no such thing in the Constitution as arms of government. We're dealing with spheres of government, exactly. We're talking about financial... we're replacing local governments with municipalities. That was Mr. Karim's... strong point. He was a little bit shocked that we used in 2009 local governments. We should have used municipalities already. I reminded him that's why he's chairperson of the standing committee now, because he comes from local government, so that's fine. Again, at paragraph F, fiscal framework, current fiscal framework, we're changing it to that financial year in which the statement is stable. So, whilst the fiscal framework spans the MTEF period, 3 years, of course, what we're looking for is in the year that statement is tabled, we want to approve that fiscal framework for that year to guide us when we're dealing with the Division of Revenue Bill and the Appropriation Bill and then the adjustments later on. So that's just the... Excuse me.
The substitution of local government with municipalities. Well, I understand. But what's the difference, the substantial difference in terms of definition?
My chair, the difference is that Mr. Karim is going to be very unhappy if we take it back. No, 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 no. For me, the the distinction is that when they passed the Local Government Systems Act, and when we passed, definitions then started moving away from local government. We started talking about municipalities. So when we're talking about local government, it's a sphere. It's a sphere, but a municipality.
Going to get into a legal debate.
No, it's not legal, sir.
Noted, Honorable Tamar.
We also favor the local government. And the reason being, if you refer now to municipalities, by system, what about the district municipalities? I mean, local government is...
Municipalities is categorized in A, B, and C municipalities.
Yeah, local government...
In terms of the fiscal systems and structures act.
I think it will be helpful if we read the provision. The medium-term budget policy statement must include, and we go down to E, the proposed substantial adjustments to conditional grant allocations to provinces, and then it used to say local governments, if any. Now, whilst province, there's a provincial sphere of government, we still have provinces specifically. And I think that's the point that the Standing Committee on Finance accepted. We're not doing a substantial adjustment to conditional grant allocation to local governments. There's only one local government. It's a sphere. But within local government, you have municipalities. So when we're talking about a specific conditional grant allocation to municipalities, not to local governments, because local government is a sphere, and within that sphere, we have municipalities. I think that's the point. It's a conceptual point, but I think that's how I understood it.
That's Thank also you. The wording in the division of revenue, if you look at all the allocations per municipality in the country. That's the wording. Honorable Monakiri?
I'm covered.
Thank you. Anyone else? Our colleagues from the provinces, you're welcome to participate. It's your meeting as well. Yes, sir?
Now, Chair, we are covered, Northwestern and Limpopo, by your summary. What gets distributed goes to municipalities, and then they are counted as municipalities. They are in a sphere of local government, but they are getting allocation as municipal entities, and then they are counted on the basis of that. If you say local governments, some of them may not take serious their responsibility on accountability back, because there's no local government that reports back. It's municipalities. We think that your summary covers us. Thanks.
Thank you for that input, Advocate Jenkins.
Thank you, Chair. I think we're moving to the amendment to subsection 3 of section 6. It's a textual thing. It used to read plural subsections. We're just going to subsection now. It's not a substantive amendment. The amendment to subsection 5 of section 6 is the next one. It's under paragraph B of clause 5. So we the following subsection, and again it's textual, but there, in fact, I must just pause for a moment. Each committee on finance must, within 15 days after the tabling of the MTBPS, the medium-term budget policy statement, which is making it lowercase, or as soon as reasonably possible thereafter, report to the NA or the NCOP, as the case requires, not maybe, but as the case, that's for consistency, on the proposed fiscal framework for the next three financial years, which report may be consolidated with the report referred to in Section 12.7, that's Section 12.7 of the Act. Chair, that, if I may, I just need to pause on this specific provision because it finds its way all throughout and we had some public submissions on this. First of all, Chair, the time frame to move from 30 days to 15. It was a proposal that was accepted. It was a proposal that came from the Standing Committee on Finance and was accepted by the Standing Committee on Finance simply because, in their experience, they can have their public hearings on the fiscal framework and report on it within that period of time and then freeze up some space to do other work. So we've received public comments on that, both from the Public Service Accountability Monitor, some, and from Dr. Miller from University of Witwatersrand, Johannesburg, GUJ. Sorry, that's a problem. They're saying we are now limiting the scope for discussion and we are limiting the scope for public engagement on the fiscal framework by this, on the one hand. And then PSAM, the Public Service Accountability Monitor, is also then saying this clause we're putting in there, as soon as reasonably possible thereafter, is bringing a lot of uncertainty to it. Chairwoman, in my opinion, we need to read it in context. What are we doing here? First of all, the 30 days or 15 days is an issue for Parliament to decide, for the committees. The committees felt that they can do this within 15 days and free up some other space because this is the experience they've had. If, let's just take worst case scenario, if there is a problem with the fiscal framework, if we need more public submissions or further engagement, this clause which PSIM actually says creates uncertainty will give us that opportunity. Because if we cannot report as a committee within the 15 days because of a reason, in other words, there's a reasonable concept that we can apply, we can say, well, this specific fiscal framework is highly problematic because of the economic climate or because there's more people who want to make submissions and we just didn't have time to listen to everything, then certainly you can extend it as long as it's reasonable. So in my opinion, it's covered. The problem is covered. One can leave it at 30 days and we can take away the reasonable possibility thereafter. That makes it very strict. So what we're trying to do with the procedure is to loosen up Parliament's ability to program, and keeping in mind that we might have some kind of issue. I mean, the example I've used in the other committees is we're hosting the World Cup again, or let's take the Olympics. Why shoot for the moon? So we have the Olympics suddenly in June, July, and that will change Parliament's calendar. It will change the way we deal with the budget, like it happened when we dealt with the World Cup that came to South Africa. So it allows for those kind of eventualities. And that is why we have created this clause in there, as soon as reasonably possible thereafter. So, Chair, I'm addressing the comments we received on that. Yes, it does create uncertainty, but it doesn't mean that it's arbitrary. You have to have a reason, and I've said it in other committees as well, it is justiciable. In other words, if someone feels, whether it's a political party or whether it is a member of the public, that Parliament is not dealing with the budget in the time frame set out in the Act, and the reasons they're giving are totally arbitrary. For some other reason, they just don't want the budget to be passed. Then one can challenge that. That will be justiciable. The reason I'm saying that, Chair, is because the concept of reasonableness has been, we have been asked plenty of times, how do you define it? What is reasonable? Is it a week, 2 weeks? It all will depend on the circumstance. It all will depend on the context of that specific decision. But it does mean that you will have to be able to answer when someone is taking you to court.
I can come in here 15 days, colleagues, in 3 weeks. That's what it actually means. 15 working days. So you do your briefing in week one, you do all your public hearings in week two, and in week three you conclude. And then the Division of Revenue Bill kicks in, and then the processing of the appropriation. That's a sequence. That's why that is 15 days.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the last issue on that paragraph is that final clause, which report may be consolidated with the report referred to in Section 12.7. Section 12.7 of the Act refers to the report on the revised fiscal framework. Now, I've indicated the reasons why we're changing the definition of fiscal framework, that is the MTEF period, And this is, in practice, what comes to Parliament. We get that one pager, or sometimes it's just that table in the documents that Treasury submits, which gives us the 3-year fiscal framework projection. That includes, in the case of the MTBPS, the revised fiscal framework for that financial year, as well as the outer 2 years. So the way we've dealt with it in the past, and there's been slight inconsistency because of certain concerns about the legality of it, we have a few times consolidated the reports to say this is the Standing Committee on Finance report on the revised fiscal framework as well as the MTBPS. And submit, because it's the same figure, the same reasons, it's the same scenario that we are reporting on. And certain concerns were then raised, but we need to have specific reports. One must be for the MTBPS and the inclusion of the fiscal framework there, and then we have a separate report for the revised fiscal framework. And this is what Dr. Miller also says in his submission. He's saying that the fact that we have the adjustments budget and the MTBPS at the same time is coincidental. In a way, it's correct, but in another way, it's not correct. I mean, if you're looking at the Public Finance Management Act and you're looking at budget reviews that goes through an annual budget cycle, countries where they do annual budget cycles, you do need that review. Remember, the review in terms of the PFMA is not an open door. You can only review the budget on certain grounds. And it is necessary as well. Now, MTBPS looks at the review and then adjusts its assumptions and its projections for the next financial year already. So it gives you that scope on the mini-budget for next year. So when we're dealing with it later this month, we'll start getting an idea of what has happened in the last 6 months of this financial year and what is possibly going to happen after this 6 months and in the new budget cycle. So, Chair, there's a good reason why we have, what I'm trying to illustrate is there's a good reason why we have your adjustments budget mid-year and why it is coming with the MTBPS, because they speak to one another. And while the one is a policy statement, the other one implements on the grounds that you're allowed to in terms of the PFMA, you implement those adjustments to the budget to make sure that you are delivering on your services that you are required to deliver in terms of the Bill of Rights. So, Chair, what that last provision is doing is to say it is allowed. You don't have to do it, but it's allowed to have one report to deal with the revised fiscal framework and the MTBPS fiscal framework. So that's just that, Chair.
Just before you carry on, there's a lady that entered the meeting. I believe she's from the Free State. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Kinalema Mpukunsi. I'm a member of the Finance Committee. Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you for
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Pumla Sibia from Pumalanga.
Pumalanga?
Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable member.
Honourable Chair, please, with your permission, can you go back to 2015?
Back to?
2015. 3015. Yes. I don't want to go back to the province and I'm unable to explain the reasons of reducing 30 days to 15. But I will tell you, what we are taking to 15 days, working days, is going to be just an issue of malicious compliance on the basis of an expectation from provinces. And the advocate, when presenting, he's presenting both. He talks about 15 and also talk about 30. But if in the deal there was 15 as minimum, and a provision that allows, in case there's a written motivation to a chair of the committee, for instance, NCOP or National Assembly, to extend to 30 days, which used to be 30 days, it will be better. Because 15 days, not 50 days, there's no other time after 15 days. This includes this 15 days, public hearings, briefings to provinces, and the mandate by the province. And the mandate by the province is not generated from a committee. It's generated by a sitting of the legislature. The committee may be fine, but it has to take it through the sitting of the legislature. So I mean that 15 days prescriptively, particularly to a budgetary and monetary adjustment, it's little bit technical to, and the province has been arguing about, when we've been going through the registers, we've been arguing about element of malicious compliance to public hearing. When the family, unemployed people, particularly youth, are made to be the ones that must do comment on public hearings on bills with special requirements. And if you take it to 15 days, officials are going to excel there. Public participation officials are going to excel. They only look to 300 people. And they can even get people who do not even understand a budget. You get it, you realize that when you're in the public hearing, that means after that, you've been forced to communicate and debate with an unrelevant participant for the particular matter you're dealing. And this one is critical for just giving public confidence in our budgetary process. So if you say 15, and I know the advocate has been doing legal arguments, he's between 15 and 30, but it's not here that date. And I'm saying that they could even qualify it in case the someone has made a written compelling reason to extend to 30. That still be allowed. 15 is a little bit, very minimal, but I can tell you, they are going to get malicious compliances. We're all going to say provinces go through, we're fine, but you know, the content has not been attended to on the basis of the time we've reduced. Thank you very much.
We note your input just to give some clarity. The fiscal framework is one part of the MTPBS. It's phase one. That's where the Standing Committee Finance, Select Committee Finance, do the work together, jointly dealing with the fiscal framework and proposed fiscal framework within the period of 15 days. The 30 days take you up to the 24th of December. In the history of Parliament in South Africa, since this institution was established, that never happened. Never happened. The second phase is the Division of Revenue Bill or the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. That is 76 legislation. In terms of the Constitution, it affects provinces. Now we're coming to that. And that is where we, as NCOP said, create more space to allow provinces to get more time to engage, not only in the provincial legislature, but also with the public participation, within a four-week cycle. It's a four-week cycle. Because why? You've got the briefing, you've got public hearings, you've got negotiating mandate, you've got final mandate to give you more space to do that work. Now we have to do it in 9 days. It's crazy. So we're coming to that part you are referring to. Yes, we were very serious on the Division of Revenue Bill or Amendment Bill. That took a chance.
No, thank you, Chair. And just on that point, Chair, if I might just correctly say that the mandate doesn't pertain there. It's the fiscal framework. I would just want to make this point. The report of the Standing Committee does see this amendment to the Money Bills Act in stages. There's the first stage of the amendments. There's a second stage that will require, I think, a little bit more thinking around certain areas. We need to apply ourselves. And this specific point, and you're correct, Chair, that we're dealing here with the fiscal amended, well, the proposed fiscal framework for next year. It's part of the MTBPS. It's the proposed fiscal framework we're saying you can report within 15 days. But it is critical for provinces to understand their role as well within the proposed fiscal framework. Because if that, if one reads the provisions, if that proposal which the Parliament will look at and say, we want a change when you're bringing the budget next year. Now, why do we want the change? Various reasons. And some of those reasons may pertain to concurrent competencies where provinces have a vested interest. And they want to say, look, that proposed fiscal framework doesn't take into account the fact that some of the provinces are far behind with infrastructure development for health services, hypothetically speaking. So that is an issue, but I want to, it's not an issue of mandates or of public hearings specifically in provinces. It's more an issue that if we're saying 15 days, and correct, Chair, I mean, that three-week period where we're looking at it is what we've always done it with, and there weren't problems with it. But what we need to establish in the second round is how can we engage with provinces when we're looking at the proposed fiscal framework. And I think Mr. Van Rooyen from the Free State a few years ago used to make that point time and time again.
What we can do is when we have the briefing on the fiscal framework, but also the public hearings, invite the provinces to attend. Yes, that's all. But when the Division of Revenue Bill is being dealt with in the provincial legislature, in terms of the briefing, the first part of that briefing includes the fiscal framework, because your Division of Revenue is based on the fiscal framework.
Yeah.
It's not something standing alone. It can't be. It's impossible.
That was my point, because it looked from the explanation that within the interaction between the portfolio committee and the select committee, provinces are excluded that we represent.
Yeah.
And I'm happy with the latest explanation.
Yes.
That they must be taken, because the very same fiscal framework will have an impact on a later process. So it is important that provinces are participating at the initial stage. Now I'm happy I'm covered if provinces will be.
Even now, in 2018, there's more engagement with the provinces than there was in 2009, because we bring the chairs more to Parliament. Come and be part of what is happening here, and then go back to your province and report.
Thank you, Chair. I think we move to subsection 6. The report may include recommendations to amend the proposed fiscal framework. We are removing should it remain materially unchanged when submitted with the national budget, because that's a limiting provision. It limits Parliament's power to actually amend the fiscal framework when it comes in the next financial year. So it's removing that. The amendments to subsection 7 of the Act, the report referred to in including this subsection 5, not just 5, must be submitted to the Minister within 7 days. Going from numerical to writing it out. I think the convention is anything from 10 and under gets written out, and anything above 10 is in numericals. So it's just a drafting thing. And again, for as soon as reasonably possible thereafter, just to create that space for Parliament's programming. Subsection 8, the House must refer matters concerning subsection, not subsections, only one. One subsection and C, D, E, and F are all paragraphs. We're including and F there because in the principal act we did not deal with F. F is, if you look at a little bit at the top, it's subsection 2F. It's the review of the actual spending by each national department. And the principal act, it was omitted to refer any of that to any committee. So we're saying that must go to the Appropriations Committee or any other committee that the House may find appropriate. So we'll send the actual spending to various portfolio committees to comment on. Chair, we're on page 6. still on clause 5 of the bill, paragraph C. It's substituting subsections 10 and 12 of section 6 of the Act. Chair, we've dealt with many of these before. Again, we're just creating consistency. If one see that the within is underlined, so we're including within now. So it's within 30 days after the tabling of the NTBPS, or as soon as reasonable possible thereafter, the committees must report to the NAONCOP, as the case requires, on the proposed division of revenue and the conditional grant allocations to provinces and municipalities. Now, municipalities we've dealt with. Replacing maybe to its requires is a drafting issue. And that is for consistency, including that within 30 days, because before that it was 30 days after the taking. So it appears in some people's interpretation of that provision that you have to wait 30 days and then report 30 days after the tabling of the NTBPS, which we've indicated earlier takes us close to Christmas. So it must be within before the 30-day period has expired. That's just for consistency. Subsection 11, again, it's just textual issues. Referring to subsection 10 of the Act may include a recommendation to amend the proposed division of revenue. It's not the division of revenue, we're still dealing with the NTBPS. And then subsection 12 is consequential amendments. Consistency, we include as soon as reasonably possible thereafter. And the 7th and subsection. So we're moving to clause 6 of the bill, page 6, substituting section 7 of the Act. Section 7 deals with the introduction of the budget, basically. We're changing the heading. And the heading used to read Introduction of the Division of Revenue Bill, the National Budget, and the Appropriation Bill. So we thought we'll make it logical. So it's Introduction of the National Annual Budget, terminology used in the PFMA, the Division of Revenue Bill, and Appropriation Bill. We're taking out the articles. I read one in there, but I should not have, but we're taking that out. So it's just the logical, also the sequencing in which the Act works. So you're dealing with the budget, which is the fiscal framework, division of revenue, and then the appropriation bill. So what we're doing in then amending subsection 1 of section 7, we're including there that when we table the national budget, it must be at the same time as the division of revenue bill. That was in the Act, but it was all the way down in, I think, subsection 3 of the Act. So we're just bringing it into subsection 1. So it's not a substantive amendment. It's just to say that we need to, yeah, so we're just dealing with it like that. The other amendments are all consequential, Chairperson, to subsection 2 of section 7, the proposed fiscal framework. We don't have to say for the financial year and subsequent 2 years because of the change in the definition. When we're dealing with paragraph C, key fiscal ratios for the next 3 financial years, you can see what we've taken out is substantively the same year and subsequent 2 years, but as I said, consequential to the change in the definition of the fiscal framework, we're just dealing with 3 financial years now. And we have the same in paragraph D, paragraph E, and paragraph G. These are all issues that in addition to Section 27 of the Public Finance Management Act, the Minister of Finance must submit to Parliament when he or she introduces the budget. So just for clarity, it's not substantive amendments. Then subsection 3 we removed because we're incorporating it in subsection 1. And the amendment to subsection 4 is textual again. It's not subsections, but subsection 1, and we're removing and 3. Because we've removed subsection 3, so we don't have to refer to it in subsection 4. So we're moving on to clause 7 of the bill that amends section 8 of the Act. Section 8 of the Act deals with the adoption of the fiscal framework. And I read correctly there, it's the article, so we've removed it, changing the heading, adoption of fiscal framework, just that. Fiscal framework, per definition, includes your revenue proposals now. So we don't have to refer specifically to the revenue proposals. And that is a consequential amendment in when we look at paragraph B of the bill. It amends subsection 1 of the Act, section 7, section 8, subsection 1. We're removing and revenue proposals. So that reads the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces must refer the fiscal framework. Fiscal framework includes revenue proposals, so we take that out, to the respective committees on finance. The committees must conduct joint public hearings on the fiscal framework. We're removing revenue proposals. It's consequential.
This joint hearing do not have an effect on the LAMUSA judgment. That is the point. Because you remember that we deal with the public hearing, the president had to prepare the act because the NCOP in particular did not conduct public hearings and they said the NA has done it. And I just wanted to that to be clarified. If you say thank you.
It is correct. I mean, the fiscal framework, first of all, it does not have an impact on the LAMUSA judgment. Or the LAMUSA judgment is not impacting on the amendments here. The LAMUSA judgment dealt with public participation, public hearings conducted by the NCOP in provinces, and whether there was a meaningful opportunity for the public to engage with that specific Section 76 legislation. And the Constitutional Court found that there were language issues, it was not interpreted in languages that everybody could understand. It was not held in areas where everybody could access the public hearings because of the vastness of certain provinces like the Northern Cape and so on. This specific provision is dealing with the fiscal framework. And in the interest of time, because it's not a piece of legislation, we can sit jointly and consider it jointly and report separately. Not a joint committee. You report separate to the two houses, but you can sit jointly and have your public participation jointly as well. But, Chair, I don't want to be misunderstood. The Constitution is clear that Parliament must facilitate public involvement in all its processes, including its legislative processes. So all its processes. We must include the public. We must invite the public. We must be open. But it's not 76. We don't have to get a provincial mandate. We can program around it. Thank you, Chairperson. So it's a joint issue. The revenue proposal is included. And amendment to subsection 3, the committees must, within 16 days after tabling of the national budget or as soon as reasonably possible thereafter, report to the NA or the NCOP on the fiscal framework. Again, revenue proposals we remove. It's included in there. That same amendment is in subsection 4. Maybe just to explain what we're doing in paragraph C of the bill. It starts with, by the substitution of paragraph B in subsection 5 of the following paragraph. These are what I call your principles of fiscal discipline. That's just, I needed a name when I made my presentations way back in 2010 and 11 to explain it. We're dealing here with subsection 5 of section 8, which says, when amending the fiscal framework or a money bill or taking any decision in terms of this act, Parliament and its committees must, and then sets out certain principles, ensure that there's appropriate balance between revenue, expenditure, and borrowing, ensure that the debt levels and debt interest costs are reasonable. In other words, when you are appropriating money and borrowing, whether locally through bonds or internationally, either through bonds or the IMF or the World Bank or the Development Bank. You must ensure that your debt levels and debt interest costs are reasonable. Now, we're changing debt interest costs to debt servicing charges. We had a discussion in the Standing Committee on Finance on that. Debt servicing charges, I think, first of all, is consistent with what's said in the Public Finance Management Act and other pieces of legislation, and it also goes beyond just the interest costs. Not just the interest we're paying on it. There can be other costs involved as well when we're dealing with debt levels. So it's a more wider concept. So that's why we have changed that one, and it finds its way later on in the schedule as well. Uh, I'll go quickly now, Chair. Chair, in Clause 8 of the Bill, amending Section 9 of the Principal Act, Section 9 deals with the Division of Revenue Bill. So that is the 76 one, which deals with the mandates. Now, Chair, the way the Act is written in Section 9, in the interest of time, we created this impression that we can have a joint meeting and discuss and adopt the Division of Revenue Bill jointly. And there's a lot of discussion. We can't, of course. I mean, we've had many problems around it. Because how can the NCOP or a select committee formally consider the Division of Revenue Bill when the National Assembly has not passed it and referred it to the NCOP, and the NCOP has referred it to the Select Committee on Appropriations? So that's the amendment we're dealing with there. So after, instead of... the way it reads at the present time is after the bill is referred to the National Council of Provinces, the bill must be referred to the Committee on Appropriations of the Council for consideration and report. So we're just trying to create certainty that you must deal with it exactly how the Constitution has envisaged you to deal with it. So you pass the Division of Revenue by the National Assembly, then it's referred to the NCOP, and the NCOP will then consider it and report on it. We try to create some consistency, and this is where we start getting to the idea of malicious compliance. So the Division of Revenue must be passed within 35 days after the adoption of the fiscal framework by Parliament, or as soon as reasonably possible thereafter. So we still have the 35 days. We didn't change that, Chairperson. One must just keep in mind that that now includes the mandate cycle, and we have now created what we've now also started terming sort of the clutch for if there is an eventuality that will require further public participation or further time that's necessary to get a mandate from a province. As long as there's a reason, we can extend that 35 days. So that's what we're doing in subsection 2.
To come in here. In terms of the rules of the NCOP, there must be at least 4 weeks. Now, you can get the 4 weeks if in a standing committee on appropriations is doing the work more speedily. Because they don't take the bill to provinces, it's the NCOP that takes the Division of Revenue Bill to a province. They don't do it. Because the mandate does it. And that's where I see something must be added, that the NCOP is just covered more. You can get the right wording. If there's a hiccup in the NA, it's going to affect us in the NCOP. I'm just leaving that to you, Advocate. You can try and explain it.
No, Chair, it's correct. The sequencing that we're dealing with is we must first adopt the fiscal framework. Both houses must adopt them separately. And then the clock starts ticking. But when that clock starts ticking, the Division of Revenue Bill is first with the National Assembly. It refers it to the Standing Committee on Appropriations, and that committee must conduct public hearings and report on the bill, and the House must sit and adopt the bill. In the meantime, the 35 days are ticking. Then it comes to the NCOP. NCOP gets it, refers it to a committee. Committee needs to receive a briefing. It might have had a briefing already, but traditionally it gets another briefing. And then it must go to provinces. There must be public participation in the provinces. There must be meetings of committees to deal with negotiating and final mandates, and then a voting mandate as well by the House. So that is all that must happen within those 35 days. So what I think, Chairperson, what you're saying is, maybe in the next round, or when we're thinking of the process, doing the budget next year, or even now with the adjustments budget, how can we codify the procedure in the National Assembly? Should there be a time limit in the National Assembly to deal with the Division of Revenue Bill? I mean, that's the obvious thing that jumps up. And obviously, these things that come out quickly might have unintended consequences, and one must look at that. But that is more or less what we're looking at. So how can we ensure that when that bill is in the NCOP, there's enough time to comply with your constitutional obligations, to get your public participation done, to get proper mandates from provinces, because that has been an issue. I'm very aware of that. We have the clause there, the clutch, as I call it, or soon as reasonably possible thereafter, but so given the public comments on that clause, I can just add, I mean, obviously it shouldn't be abused. It's there for a reason, and it should be applied and implemented to give effect to the budget cycle, and not just to abuse it because the planning is bad. But that's maybe another story for another day. So subsection 5 of section 9 deals with what the standing rules must provide for. We're taking out the participation of chairpersons of other committees, and said participation should be by the committees. The chairperson is merely a representative of the committee. And the committee can decide to mandate the chairperson or anyone in the committee to make input. But what it says is that standing rules must allow that participation of other committees, dealing with the Division of Revenue Bill. If we go down that page, we're changing again local governments with municipalities for the reasons stated earlier. When we get to the amendment to subsection 6, paragraph C, that subsection 6 reads, the reports of the respective committees on appropriations must at least, then go to C, demonstrate that the impact of the amendments has been taken into account in respect of service delivery obligations and all affected national departments, provincial governments, and municipalities. So it's just trying to clarify that part that we're saying. If we amend the Division of Revenue Bill, how do we exactly envisage that that will affect the various departments? And we just provide clarity what departments we are talking about in changing municipalities from local government. We go to paragraph or subsection 7. The Committee on Appropriations, not the committees, the drafting issue, must consult with the FFC and allow the minister to respond to any proposed amendments, because the amendments are not made yet, and we're just changing the numbering, not the numbering around, but the qualifier, the proposed amendment, at least 3 days, and we're writing that out again. That's not really substantive. And the same in subsection 8, using the plural instead of the singular, because it's more than just one committee that's going to be reporting to the House. So we're going to section 10. We're on page 8 of the bill. We're dealing with section 10, which is the passing the appropriation bill. When I look at that one, it's probably take the out in the title there. Passing of the appropriation bill. After the adoption of the fiscal framework, the appropriation bill is referred to the committees on appropriation, or the Committee on Appropriations of the National Assembly, because the legislative process. We're changing the wording in paragraph B. The minister must table the proposal setting out the purpose and strategic performance information for each vote against its expected revenue and proposed expenditure by program, main division, and economic classification. So that change is coming through the changes made to these budget documents and how we refer to the various aspects that we want the committees now to take into account. These are the documents that the committee, well, mostly portfolio committees, will receive when we get the budget, when we're dealing with the appropriation bill. And then suddenly the departments come and they say, here is my strategic plan, and here's all my other, this includes all my objectives, my purpose. So with the change of wording is just to be consistent with those documents that we receive then. Paragraph C, we're including constitutional institution and not just institution. Also the wording that we use in the Public Finance Management Act. We get to subsection 2 of section 10 after the appropriation bill is passed by the National Assembly and referred to the NCOP, the bill must be referred to the Committee on Appropriations of the National Council of Provinces. Just for clarity's sake, and follows the legislative process set up in the Constitution. The next amendment, we taking the capitals of Committee of Appropriations away because it's more of a we're referring generically to the Committee on Appropriations, and just that other committees may advise them to for conditional appropriation if there are issues that must be taken into account. That was in the Act, so just clarity or tidying up the Act. Same with paragraph A of subsection 5. When we get to subsection B, it used to be the minister or the affected member of cabinet. Why do we exclude the minister? Why must it be one or the other? So clearly it was just to clarify that it can be either or both, or a number of members of cabinet. The minister and the affected must be given at least 2 days. We said, why are we changing 2 days? And that response, of course, must be included in the report containing the recommendation. Recommendation to amend the appropriation bill. We're removing paragraph C because that's not incorporated in paragraph B. And the changes to paragraph D is again just taking it to lower caps, generic committee on appropriations, and writing out 7. The same in terms of capitals in paragraph 6, as well as what the standing rules in subsection 8 must provide for it, because we're generically referring to committee on appropriations, we're taking the capitals off. And that takes us onto page 9. Similarly, all of that and what we're doing at the end of that section, this is an amendment to section 10, clause 9, we're putting a paragraph G in, because subsection 10, subsection 10 of section 10 deals with what the report of a committee must include. So what we're saying is it must include responses of the minister and the effect or the effective member of cabinet to any proposed amendments. And that was a standalone section, that's subsection 11, which we've removed and just incorporated into G above. It's also not substantive, we just incorporated. So here we're going, still on page 9, amendment of section 11. Section 11 deals with revenue bills. The changes there, Chair, again to the heading, removing the article. Revenue bills must be referred generically to Committee on Finance of the National Assembly. We're dealing with the legislative process in subsection 2. After the National Assembly passed the revenue bill, the bill must be referred to the NCOP and referred to the Committee on Finance of the National Council of Provinces. We include that. It was not included in the Principal Act, but it must specifically go to the Finance Committee, Standing Committee on Finance. And Chair, when it comes to revenue bill, subsection 4, we've just changed the structure of the subsection. We're now including Committee on Finance at the top and we're taking it out in each little subparagraph. Must hold public hearings on the revenue bill, consult with other committees and report to the House in terms of subsection 6. That was an error to refer to subsection 7. I'm now right at the bottom of page 9. So we're just correcting that from the Principal Act. So we're on page 10, clause 11 of the bill, dealing with amendments to section 10, section 12 of the Principal Act, dealing with the National Adjustment Budget. Chair, the first amendment is consequential to the Public Finance Management Act. I mentioned it earlier. The Minister may table a National Adjustment Budget as envisaged in section 30 of the PFMA. The Principal Act as it stands now says it must happen, but the PFMA say it's a discretion. If it's needed, it can happen. So there has been comments on that, I think, before the Standing Committee on Finance, which says that it allows the Minister not to table a National Adjustment Budget. But the Minister has always had that power not to table an Adjustment Budget if it's not necessary. So we're just making it consistent with the Public Finance Management Act. The Adjustments Appropriation Bill must be tabled with, now we're using a definitive article, the Adjustments Budget, because we're referring to that specific year, so it's for clarity. We're looking at Subsection 4, the Minister must table a Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. Using capitals there because we're referring specifically to that bill that will come, and it's not just generically. Going down to Subsection 6, if the Minister tables a Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, and capitalizing it, it must be referred to, and here we are making a substantive change, Chair. One can see there that as the Act stands, it must be referred to a joint sitting of the Committees on Appropriations after the adoption of the revised fiscal framework by the House. Now, Chair, that is a constitutional problem to have it like that, because when we're dealing with 76 legislation, you have to follow that legislative process, and that is what we intended to do with the amendments that follows in Section 6 and then the new Section 6, capital A. Committee on Appropriations, so the bill is after the adoption of the fiscal framework, Committee on Appropriations of the National Assembly received the bill. And then 6A, after the National Assembly passed the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, the bill must be referred to the National Council of Provinces and referred to the Committee on Appropriations of Provinces, of the National Council of Provinces. Chair, so what we are doing there, I mean, it remains the same. It's only after the revised fiscal framework is passed by Parliament that we are referring the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill to the NA and then to the NCOP. Now, we're very aware, Chair, of the time constraints that the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill has experienced. And we're addressing that in subsection 7. So now the Committees on Finance must, instead of 9, we're saying within 15 days after the tabling of the National Adjustments Budget, or as soon as reasonably possible thereafter, submit the report on the revised fiscal framework to the respective houses, which report may be consolidated with the report referred to in 6.5, which we're dealing with the MTBPS. I referred to that earlier. So that those two clauses, 6.5 and this one, 12.7, will speak to each other. So again, we can deal with that. And we're giving 15 days for that process. So there's consistency in terms of that. So we're giving more time to deal with the fiscal framework, amended fiscal framework. The report may propose amendments. This next amendment we make is just writing out of 2. Now, Chair, when we see we're removing subsection 11 of the Principal Act, the Committees on Appropriations must 9 days after the adoption of the fiscal framework report to the respective houses on the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. That clause we've removed, Chair. So there is no time constraint of 9 days hanging over the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. But there is still a time constraint for the whole process. If we look at subsection 19, and I'll deal with that, it's on page 11, we're still keeping that the whole adjustments budget, or at least the appropriations, must happen within 30 days. So that total time constraint is there. We still have that. The fiscal framework has said you can have 15 days to deal with it, amended fiscal framework. And that short period we gave for the Division of Revenue Amendment will be removed. But we've left the outside table, the framework. So what we are hoping to achieve is to free up space in the middle for whatever can happen, for programming to happen, so that provinces can play their constitutional role in mandating the NCOP to deal with the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill.
I'm stating it again, and it must be minuted. There must be a four-week space for the NCOP and provinces to deal with the Division of Revenue Bill or the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. That must be minuted. Because it's not about us sitting here. It's about those coming after us that must implement the legislation and in the legislature. So, thank you.
Now, Chair, that we hope will be achieved through proper programming. Because when we look at the time frames, we have to report within 30 days after the tabling of the National Adjustments Budget. So you have 30 days for the whole process, which translates into 6 weeks. So ideally you want to say, okay, let's take 2 weeks, 10 days, for the fiscal framework to be finalized and adopted. And then you will have your 4 weeks left for your Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. Keeping in mind, of course, that the NCOP must still pass the adjustment budget. You're going to have a few days necessary for that, and we have had problems with that as well. So be carefully programmed, because there's overlaps. You can see that the way the time frames are structured now, there are overlaps. If you take your full 15 days for the fiscal framework, you're not left with 4 weeks, you're left with 3 weeks. So one needs to program that very carefully. That's for instance one proposal that one can think of.
The members are putting that on the table. Because that was the past 9 years was a challenge. It was a serious challenge.
Chair, we support your proposal to move the 30 days to the 40 days so that it gives enough time even to the provinces. I think it's reasonable.
Because if you take your 30 days from the 24th of October, you're going to end up early in December. Let's add on another week. If you do it in a shorter period, fantastic, but I think there must be additional space created. Taking next year as election year, you're going to have the SONA, national budget includes the fiscal framework, division of revenue. Well, that will take us up to March, the end of March. This institution will adjourn. Close up for the elections. Coming back, the sixth parliament will deal with the appropriation bill. Yes. In that space of time. So I'm just giving you the picture. What is the reality we are facing? Anyone else? Yes, sir?
I'm sure I want to support the 40 days. I think the this bill becomes everything else falls on it. It's the elephant in the room. So even the other portfolios depend on the work around this this bill. So 40 days for me will give us enough time.
Anyone else? We must protect the procedures of the NCOP, but also our legislators dealing with 76 legislation. That's why I'm making this proposal. Advocate Jenkins.
Thank you, Chairperson. On that point, we have the, what I again call the clutch clause. As soon as reasonably possible thereafter, it's there. So to keep it in mind in terms of processing this specific provision in the amendment bill, I think the institution best place to answer, if there are any problems with the 40 days, would be to see, I mean, I don't see how it impacts on Parliament as much, especially if it can be allowed the way it's written in the amendment bill, but I don't know what the holdup might be with Treasury. One might just ask their input on that. But I think, Chair, that we deal with when we consider the clauses and I mean, I'm just making a suggestion. I mean, but we've noted it here, both Michael and myself, that 40 days is a proposal that the committee will consider. I think fine. So I think, Chair,
recent members and colleagues, finance and appropriations in the NCOP is the same members. In the NA, it's two totally different committees with different membership. So the pressure is here. It's not so much on that side in the National Assembly. So we must protect in terms of our rules, what we are doing here, in terms of the directors. Honorable de Blanche.
To create space for ourselves, or then at least the committee. I am just wondering whether the so-called clutch clause will not serve the very same purpose.
Clause?
Clutch clause. I'm taking the term from that, okay. It's a clutch for clay. Anyway, so reason being, you know, if you have that maneuverability, you can go over, you know, within reason. You know, because there's another danger. If you go now for a specific time frame again, like 40, people will work on the 40. So the clutch clause, I think, serves whatever we want to achieve. That is just my view. Thank you.
Just highlight that clause again. Let me just find it here.
Yes, Chair. That's on page 11. Amendment, yeah, line 30. The amendment to subsection 19. Yeah, so we include that part. So it must be within 30 days or as soon as reasonably possible thereafter. And what I think what Honourable Treblanche is saying, it's part of the sort of social makeup of humans. You give them more space, they're going to take it. So I just need to go back to end of page 10 and the top of page 11. I skipped over that. It's new provisions that we're introducing, 15A, and that is just to deal with the legislative process and to remove this uncertainty about is it a joint meeting when we're dealing with the adjustments budget or what it is. So it's just to make it clear that after the NA passed the adjustments appropriation bill, it's referred to the NCOP and then referred specifically to the Committee on Appropriations of the NCOP. And then the Committee on Appropriations, and this is important, Chair, may only report on the adjustments appropriation bill after Parliament has passed the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. Because we are referring both after the adoption of the fiscal framework, both of the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill and the Adjustments Appropriation Bill is referred to the committees. Of course, both will go first to the Standing Committee on Appropriations, and they will deal with it in the sequence of Division of Revenue Amendment Bill and then Adjustments Appropriation Bill. Now, while the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill is before the NCOP, then it goes to the Select Committee on Appropriations. That committee can start dealing with it. The NA committee can't make adjustments to the, can't make amendments to the Adjustments Appropriation Bill before the NCOP has finalized their work on the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. That's just to keep the sequencing on the one hand, but just to create space that the NA committee doesn't have to wait like it was in the past or presently. You don't have to wait until the Division of Revenue Bill is adopted by the NCOP before you even get the Adjustments Appropriation Bill referred to you. So you can start preparing, dealing with it, have your public hearings. You can't change anything in that bill before the NCOP has finalized their work on the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. That's what 15A and 15 capital B is trying to do. Chair, with your permission, on page 11, clause 12 of the bill, passing of other money bills. Chair, it's really consequential amendments, both to the title. You can see most of them is just bringing the sort of proper noun committee of appropriations down to generic. A committee on appropriations. We're dealing there in subsection 4, paragraph B, removing of this act, because we're referring just to the section in the act. There's no problem with that. And changing the two to on. So those are just consequential amendments. So then we get to the amendment of Section 15 of the Act that deals with the Parliamentary Budget Office. There's a few changes that were made in that. I think just to give an introduction to the changes, because it's quite a voluminous amount of amendments. First of all, there was an issue with the Parliamentary Budget Office being established as a separate juristic person. That has not happened up till now. So there's been a debate, in fact, whether it is a separate juristic person or not. And the Principal Act, as it stands, indicates that, one, there must be a transfer of funds to the PBO, and the director is accountable to the Houses of Parliament through the Executive Authority for the expenditure and for the performance of the Budget Office. So while this debate is there, we've just, what I would say, we've been consistent with the policy position that since 2009, Budget Office was envisaged to be a separate juristic person within Parliament. So the PBO is run by a director, and that director is accountable for the financial as well as the performance and the human resource allocation within that office, accountable to the Houses. That is more or less consistent with what we've heard in the international conferences on the PBO. And I should say what I've read, because I couldn't go to those ones which the PBO organized here at Parliament. But there's been some submissions made by various institutions that says your budget office needs to be standing separate from Parliament and advise Parliament on the budget. There's other models as well, and we went to, not myself specifically, I went on a tour way back then, but when the people went to South Korea and Japan, you have a budget office that's incorporated in Parliament, but it's sort of standalone. In the USA, you have a total congressional budget office. It's a separate building. It's away from Congress. In Kenya, I went there on a study tour when we dealt with this part. You have your budget office within Parliament. I don't know if they developed further, because we've met some of them now at the latest conference. Sweden, you have your budget office inside Parliament. It's a division of your Parliament administration. But the general principle in international practice is that you have some kind of arm's length between your accounting officer for Parliament administration and your accounting officer for the PBO. And that's what we tried to create here, and that was the policy position initially in Section 15 of the Act. But we're making it clear. Section 1 amendment is just that is a juristic person headed by the director, and the rest is all the same. The amendment is, then we go to subsection 5, which deals specifically with the appointment of the director. What we've done there is we've included, and this was a public submission, actually, it came from Dr. Schumacher, must appoint a fit and proper person. The fit and proper person is not in the original Principal Act. Once you're appointed, certainly you must be fit and proper, because you can be removed for not being fit and proper, in other words, for misconduct or incapacity. But before you can even be considered for that position, we made it that you have to be fit and proper, and that is actually standard practice with many of the appointees of this kind of institution. We're looking at appointees to the conduct authority within the Reserve Bank, on which this amendments are based, by the way. If you're looking at the market conduct authority, if you're looking at directors that must be appointed to companies, when one looks at most of these people that have some authority to deal with financial issues, you have to be a fit and proper person. So that's the main amendment, although we've rewritten the whole clause. What we have done is we've also added the ability in paragraph C. You may, based on performance, renew the contract referred to in paragraph A on substantially the same conditions of service as contemplated in paragraph B. So while the Houses determine the conditions of service of the director, a discussion did come up, as you are aware, Chairperson, to renew the contract of the director, the president, or I think the director has resigned now, former director has resigned now. But it was renewed, and we've just made that clear that the Houses do have that authority to renew the contract. That's the amendment to paragraph C. Chair, I'm just going to run down that. Subsection C, any committee considering a recommendation, not making a recommendation, so that's just for clarity, must do so in an open and transparent manner. That pertains to the appointment of the director and then making the recommendation to the House. Amendment to subsection 9, the director shall be obliged to, I think we can just capture that in one word, must. The director must report to Parliament any inappropriate political or executive interference, just for clarity. The next amendment, that's paragraph F of the bill, page 12, line 39, amending section or subsection 10. The Parliamentary Budget Office must annually receive a transfer of funds from Parliament's budget in accordance with section 35 of the Financial Management of Parliament and Provincial Legislatures Act. It makes it clear how they get their budget. Yes. So that's how the budget must... Presently, the budget is a budget allocation, and the PBO is seen as a program within Parliament. So in terms of this provision, it will be very clear that you have to have that transfer of funds. And that will then speak to the policy objective of having a juristic person, a separate juristic person within Parliament's administration, headed by the director. So that's the intention on that one. So one of the issues that came up when this, and on an administration level, when this discussion was had about transferring funds to the PBO, to the director, and the accountability for it, was that because our PBO is really in it was, let's say, was in its infancy stages in 2010, how can we ensure that they have proper funds?
Sorry for interruption. Honorable Monarchy.
Thanks, Chair. I just want some clarity regarding these particular provisions that we are now discussing. And that is as to why these particular provisions are not covered, say, under the Financial Management of Parliament provision, which I asked. Why are they not covered there, but here instead? Because the bill is about the process that has to be followed in amending money bills. And here you are dealing with the creation and the appointment of the director. So I'm just trying to understand, that's why are you catering for that in this particular bill, not in the other one that I've just referred to?
Honorable Monarchy is the co-chair of the Joint Standing Committee on the Financial Management of Parliament. So yeah, he's got another cap on as well. Edgar Jenkins?
Chair, when you said that, it's an interesting question, because is the director then going to appear before the Joint Standing Committee on Financial Management of Parliament? I think not. I think what will happen is the accounting officer of Parliament, the Secretary of Parliament, will appear there and will have to say, yes, I have complied with the Money Bills Act. Yes, I've transferred the funds. And when we're looking at Section 35 of the Financial Management of Parliament Act, there's certain conditions upon which you must transfer funds. You must get some assurance that there's sound financial management and accountability and transparency within the financial systems of whoever you transfer funds to. So what we've said with this Act, first of all, the reason why it's only in this Act and it's not in the Financial Management of Parliament is we do want to create the distance. I mean, practically, it's because we're dealing with this Act, and because the Act from the beginning has provided for the administrative support for the implementation of the procedure to amend money bills. That's initially why it was put in there, was to say, look, we have this big procedure now. How are we going to support this procedure? Are we going to hand it over to the Secretary of Parliament so that the Secretary can create capacity and allocate tasks and delegate functions? Or are we going to have a separate entity that deals just with the budget in Parliament, the national budget? And because of international practice that I've explained, the decision was taken to say, no, we want a separate budget office. And that's the reason why it is in here. But with the development of the budget office, various accounting officers of Parliament has raised the question that the budget office doesn't have the capacity, doesn't have the financial systems to ensure proper financial accounting. All of those systems are housed within Parliament's administration. And the same goes for the human resource management. So if you want to appoint someone as a official in the budget office, who's in charge of sending out an advert, setting up a panel for the interview, what policies determine how this must happen? Let's just add here while I'm saying this. Remember, from a public official's point of view, member of Parliament or legal advisors or anybody. You can only do what the law allows you to do. If the law doesn't allow you to do something, you can't do it. All the authority must be written in law. So we have to write in law what the director can do. And one of the arguments that has come out through the years was to say, well, it's very, very cryptic what the director can do and cannot do. So who's going to make the appointments? Who's going to sign the appointment contracts with the deputy directors and the officials, administrative officials of the budget office? And at this point in time, it's signed by the Secretary of Parliament, if I'm not mistaken, because that's where the sort of authority lies, the practice, all the processes, and the control over those processes lies with the accounting officer of Parliament. Notwithstanding the fact that since the Principal Act was passed, the intention was to have a separate entity, some kind of separate, some separation, some juristic person that has control over the human resource and funding of the budget office, so that they can focus just on that, so they don't get almost absorbed within the greater parliament administration. So that's the reason why we kept separate. And I'm not saying we as administration, that's the reason why the Standing Committee on Finance, well, they were the Portfolio Committee on Finance then, decided to have a whole standalone provision for the budget office. At the time, and it was interesting, if I may share, at the time when it was drafted, we were running out of time in 2009 because of there was a change in presidency at the time. I think President Mbeki has just resigned, and we're going to have a standing president, and the committee members are going to be dispersed. So there was a very short time period to do it. And I think Honorable Nhlanhla Nene and Barbara Hogan were in the committee. And when it came to that part, the last part of the legislation, one of the proposals that was raised by officials, myself, was to say, we just give the responsibility to the Secretary of Parliament. Let the Secretary of Parliament deal with it. That's the easiest way to do it. And the discussion was held and said that is not how PBOs should function worldwide and also not in South Africa. We want a separate standalone entity, so we need to write what the budget office functions are, who will be accountable for the expenditure, how will it be funded, how can we appoint and remove the director, etc., etc. So we did that, and it was a short space of time, and what we're trying to do with the amendment is to elaborate a little bit. And to say what exactly are your specific obligations that the director must be able to do. In other words, what we also want to give to, let's say, the manager of the PBO, to say you can make a checklist for the director. This is what the director is responsible for. The director must be able to report on all these responsibilities. And to achieve that, what we did was we borrowed from the Financial Sector Regulation Act, which create this prudential authority within the Reserve Bank. To say that it's a very similar structure. I mean, it's also a separate juristic person within the Reserve Bank that reports separately, but in the same annual report as the Reserve Bank. So we thought, well, that creates a separate PBO if we take it. You can see where your annual report is. You're responsible for that amount that was transferred to you, but you don't have to duplicate all your own financial reports. You don't have to duplicate your annual report. You can deal with it like that. So, I mean, I'm just trying to explain why it's there. And then what follows there is just what I said about what's called the principle of legality. To say, let's put exactly what the director must do in there so the director can know what to do and know what he or she will be accountable for. So that's the chair. I don't know if I should. Is it fine? I mean, what we are now on page... So what we dealt with the transfer of funds, and then we put in this new section in the bill, 10A, 10 capital A, and that is what we borrowed from the Financial Sector Regulation Act. And this is, in short, your fiduciary duties of the director. So the chair, I can read the whole thing for you if it helps. But in essence, it says that the director is the accounting officer of the PBO, and is responsible for the financial and human resource management of the office. And then it starts in paragraph B, director must exercise the utmost care to protect the assets and records of the PBO, act with fidelity, honesty, integrity, and in the best interest of the PBO in managing the financial affairs, seek within the director's sphere of influence to prevent any prejudice to the financial interests of the Republic, so that goes to the content and the quality of the work, ensure that the PBO has and maintain effective, efficient, transparent systems of financial and risk management, effective, efficient, and transparent systems of internal audit and a procurement and provisioning system that is fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost-effective. Of course, that procurement issue comes from, I think it's section 216 or 218 of the Constitution. Take appropriate and cost-effective steps to collect revenue where it's due to prevent losses resulting from criminal conduct and expenditure that's not in accordance with the PBO, so that's your lapses in your procurement. Manage available working capital efficiently and economically. Manage and safeguard the assets of the PBO, the revenue, expenditure, and liabilities. Establish systems and processes to ensure that effective and appropriate disciplinary steps are taken against any staff member of the PBO who contravenes a law relevant to the performance of the PBO or engages in conduct that undermines the financial management and internal control systems of the PBO. Generally ensure that the PBO complies with its legal obligations. It's a compliance issue, and the director must ensure, this is now the reporting part, full and proper records of the financial affairs of the PBO are kept and maintained. Prepare financial statements for the PBO for each financial year that forms part of the annual report of Parliament to prevent duplication. Annually submit to the Executive Authority for tabling in Parliament a rolling three-year budget in time for the inclusion in Parliament's budget, and submit to the Executive Authority, and by the way, that's why we have a definition of Executive Authority in the beginning, a report on the use of funds and activities and performance of the PBO, including any matter that may be prescribed by regulation in terms of this Act. So, I mentioned earlier that we can have regulations in terms of this Act, that's why we have a definition for this Act, and that is, it's a very limited scope which the Executive Authority can make regulations. They can make it in terms of the Financial Management of Parliament Act as well. In other words, what is the format of your report? What do you need to put in there? We've put in the basics. If there need to be more, it can be done through regulation. So, Chair, that's your fiduciary duties and your areas where the director needs to be very aware of how he or she should report and what they should do. Then we repeal subsection 11 of section 15 because it's incorporated. That's a reporting provision. So that section 11 has now grown. It's gotten a whole family in the new clause which I've just read out. Then, Chair, when I move on to subsection 13, subsection 13 in the Principal Act deals with the structure of the PBO and the conditions of service, deputy directors and personnel of the PBO. Now, what we're saying there is that instead of saying the director in consultation with the committees referred to in Section 4, those are your finance and your appropriations committees of the two houses. Instead of doing that, you must now, in consultation with an advisory board, the definition of which we discussed at the definition clause, deal with that. And that is for practical reasons, but we've received public comments on that. The public comments are that it is not a transparent process. When it is in consultation with four committees, there will be a committee meeting, needless to say, a joint meeting between the four committees and the director, and in that meeting we will do the structure of the budget office and discuss the conditions of service and so on. So the submission is saying, look, the advisory board, they don't think it's going to work because all the chairpersons of those four committees as well as the house chairpersons are from one political party, namely the ruling party. Therefore, it's not an open process and there's not enough pluralism within that committee. In the Standing Committee on Finance, when that issue was raised, the chairperson indicated that it's a purely administrative function, it's not a political function that is being performed there. You know, it's not a committee area of wanting to work. From a practical perspective, in Parliament, it's very difficult to get four committees to sit together and to come up with a decision in consultation with. It's not impossible, but it's very difficult. Public submission from the Public Service Accountability Monitor, some, saying, if it can't be the four committees, and it can't be the advisory board, which they do not think is the appropriate mechanism, another mechanism must be found to fulfill this function. So that is where we are on that. Chairperson, from my side, I just want to comment. I'm not going to make a proposal. I just want to comment to say that presently, this advisory board, which is in a practical arrangement, all the members are from the same party. But it hasn't always been like that in my tenure in Parliament as a legal advisor. I mean, we've had House chairpersons from various political parties. Given that there was a single majority ruling party in Parliament, we've had House chairpersons from various opposition parties. So that can be done. So what I'm saying is, the fact that all four at the present time is from the ruling party doesn't mean that it will always be from the ruling party, even if we have a big majority ruling party in Parliament. Yeah. One can also then say, but what if you don't have a ruling party, if you have coalitions within Parliament like you have in municipalities in Pretoria and Gauteng, then that comment will also fall away to say, but they're all from the same party. So it's a reflection, that's the comment I want to make. The comment from some and from Dr. Miller is a reflection on the present state of affairs. It's not a guarantee that it will always be like that. Because I think what they want to achieve is two things. One, they want a more transparent process. And two, they want a more pluralistic process. In other words, different political parties taking decisions around the structure and the conditions of service of the Parliamentary Budget Office. Okay. Now, the issue of transparency within the Budget Office is a very interesting question, because when we're dealing with the structure of Parliament itself, Parliament administration, we're dealing with conditions of service under which I operate. Even I don't know how that is going to be debated. That gets debated between the how and the executive leadership of the institution. I just get told that I'm getting an extra 2 days or I get 2 days less leave. That's it. So I think transparency is a constitutional imperative, but when it comes to the administration of an institution, there's certain areas of transparency. You cannot expect the administration of Parliament or the PBO to be open and to say, well, let's call for public hearings. We want to decide today whether we should have compulsory leave in December and whether Parliament should fund half of that compulsory leave, or whether it should all come off the annual leave of the deputy directors. I'm just saying, Chair, commenting, that is not necessarily open for public to look at and to sit there and to listen to that. The public can't make submissions on that in any event. It's a labour negotiation. And the issue of the single party all being represented in that advisory board is a reflection of the present state of affairs. I'm saying these things, Chair, just to assist the committee. I hope it assists. If it doesn't, my apologies for taking the time. But it's just to assist the committee to deal with both the public submission and the comments, the public submission and the amendment that we are proposing there. Chair, with your permission, I'll move on. The next thing is exactly the same. Instead of the committees, the...
Yeah, no, thanks very much, Chairperson. Just have one question probably to be clarified before we proceed. And the question is around the point which Advocate has been raising around accountability and transparency. And for me, the understanding is that through the process of the board, if it is to be established and become functional through the appointment of the director as well, transparency for me is a system that has got to underpin the operations of the board, I suppose. And how we characterize it should not necessarily be in terms of, warm bodies, their biological makeup, that therefore then reinforces the strength of transparency or accountability. And I think from what he's saying, it gives an impression that it is not a system that is underpinning the operations of this envisaged office, but it has got to be understood within the makeup of the persons who would constitute this board. I'm not sure whether I'm getting him correctly, but I'm a little bit lost because the principle that is alluding to of pluralism and so on and so on, in my understanding, I understand them differently, but from the point he's raising is bringing a political perspective that says if there's one assumption, and therefore it means there is no a transparency or accountability. He seemed to be explaining it within the defines or the confines of a multi-party presence in a particular establishment. Is that the case? So that before we proceed, I think that clarity for me is very important, Chair.
Yes, no, my apologies. I don't think I'm falling a little bit over my words. I like talking, but not so much. So I'm being, I think, rushing over my own thoughts. The principles you've correctly identified, it's transparency and pluralism. But the principles of pluralism, if I can deal with that one first, that's a public submission. They are saying we want pluralism, but it's not there because of the present makeup. My response to that is to say the present makeup is what it is. It's all members of the ruling party that sits on that board, the practical board as it is at present. But it hasn't always been like that, and it might not be like that after the elections next year. So we must see the comments in the context of the present situation. It's not necessarily something wrong with the legislation. It's not necessarily wrong at all. In fact, when you're looking at principles of democracy, there's nothing wrong with what you're doing. The chairpersons of committees comes from the ruling party. So that deals with the plural. The comment is that we want more pluralism there. I'm saying we can deal with that. The comment comes from a certain perspective, but the committee can decide. We can say, like we did with the Pan-African Parliament, to say that two members of the five delegates must be from opposition parties and there must be gender representation on that. Nothing wrong with saying that in this instance. The other point I made, following on the argument of pluralism, and that touches on transparency. So again, I must not now fall over my tongue here, is that we are dealing with a certain objective here. The objective is the management of the PBO. And the accountability and the transparency needs to feed into the houses. So we need political oversight over how the PBO operates. We don't have that with the administration of parliament. There you just have the accounting officer reporting to the houses through the executive authority, through the chairperson of the NCOP and the speaker of the NA. So when I'm talking about accountability and transparency, it's very important to realize what are we actually dealing with here. Now, are we dealing here with a decision that's going to be taken that's going to affect the wider public, and to what extent? And I would almost argue that the more you affect the wider public, like with legislation, the more transparency you need, the more participation from the public you need. As I said, when it comes to my conditions of service within Parliament, it doesn't affect anybody out there. There's no transparency. It's a negotiation from a bargaining unit to executive management, and I get a memo from that. So I would say that's one area. I mean, one can go into a family and say there's no transparency in how family relations operate either. When we're dealing with legislation, the more it affects people outside the decision-making process, the more transparency should be there, and even participation from the people who are affected. So when we're dealing with this specific clause, and that's the point I made, is to say that I don't think, this is the comment, I don't think that this area of the conditions of service of deputy directors and officials within the PBO, it does not affect the public to such an extent that transparency becomes the ultimate objective, or even participation. The accountability must remain. Accountability both for the people who took that decision. And that is the interesting part of this amendment, because it's a counter-argument against those who are saying it should be four committees. Who's going to be accountable for making a decision in consultation with the director that turns out to be the wrong decision when it comes to the structure of the PBO? Because it's very difficult to hold a committee accountable, because within a committee the principle of majoritarianism applies. If you can't agree on an outcome, you're going to have to take a majority vote.
And those, much like the companies now, those directors who are not voting for that must be then minuted to say, look, I'm not taking accountability for that decision. So that's another thing. But the accountability as it's written at the moment, when a decision is taken about the structure of the board, and even the next section about appointing an acting director, there's accountability for that advisory board. And that advisory board must be able to explain to the houses, who's the ultimate custodian of the operations of the PBO, explain to the houses why they've appointed that person as an acting director and not another person, if the first person turned out to be the wrong choice for whatever reason. So that's more or less what I'm getting in dealing with the comments. But I'm not trying to say to the committee, you can't consider another option other than the advisory board. While I'm saying that, I'm not being facetious, Chair, but it is a procedural issue. This is a 75 legislation. So this committee can make proposed amendments to that. But you can't amend it. You'll make proposed amendments like any Section 75 legislation. But that's all I'm saying. So I'm saying it's not the apex of the purpose of this provision. The purpose of this provision and the amendment is to make it more functional. Rather than have four committees, have an advisory board. The comment saying, but what about your principle of transparency? And I'm trying to address that to say that's not the apex purpose of this provision. Is that fine, Chair?
Okay.
Thanks, Chair. I think in terms of the current issue and the discussion, I think I want to link to what the legal advisor is saying. And I think for me, what is more important is for the board to work in line with standards of how boards must work, particularly King 4. So I think once we ensure something like that, I think it covers. I think the other issues are officious. Yes. I wanted to raise something else as well, just to be noted. At clause 10, Roman figure 2, I wanted to check with the lawyer that can't we be more elegant and not use a parliamentary budget office twice in one sentence? Maybe say, act with fidelity, honesty, integrity, and in the best interest of the Parliamentary Budget Office in managing its financial affairs, full stop, and not repeat the Parliamentary Budget Office.
Referring to the structure of the sentence. Honourable Sir Blanche.
Listen, thank you. I want to recommend that we do consider, you know, to have, if we can call it that, more representativity. You know, obviously, if you take the whole model that we have, our constitution and how our government is formed, and representation, what the very essence of that is, to give as many people and as many views as possible, you know, the opportunity to have a say and impact and whatever. And from that view, I really want to strongly recommend that we move away from a situation where, you know, if we have the situation that we have now, you know, that we have a broader sort of an audience that can give input and bring about balance and stuff like that. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable members, I serve on that board. It's an admin exercise. That's what it is. There's nothing else to it. If someone must take my place, I can do it anytime. I recognize, yes, sorry.
Yeah, sure. I think that the issue on pluralism must not be used as a basis to indirectly contest or frustrate the electoral outcomes. So people must not lose in elections, which was a public contest, open, meant to have representatives in Parliament and then have a formal way to control through submission to certain bills. The issue of chairpersons being from one political party has not been taken to court by the same people. Tomorrow they are going to say cabinet doesn't stand the test of pluralist confirmation for South Africans because all cabinet ministers are from one ruling party. So that is only said by some individuals. However, if the issue is on the basis of representativity of your political parties in parliament, it must be raised as that there's a need to open the space to the board to have that. It must then be considered by parliament as that, but it must not be from an outsider who says, if it's only chairpersons from one political party, the same outsider must tell us. Because Western Cape is a provincial legislature ruled by an opposition party. People who lost elections in Western Cape can't have a complaint that we suspect there can be pluralism there because almost all chairpersons will be from the same party. And this is exactly the same thing that the presenter is arguing about municipal outcomes. And then if the issue is necessary representativity of political parties that are represented in National Assembly, let it be addressed like any other matter, almost like the example you have made, the presenter, the advocate, the issue about the files that were sent to African AA. So the definition could then be done in a certain way, but the assumption must not be created by an outsider silently, that there are people who don't know that they could have interests of the Constitution of South Africa adopted with all forms of its contents, that they could not have them because they don't trust them. They can be distrusted by people to an extent that is made formulation, even the issue of a definition of fit and proper. It's graduating towards individuals in public hearings wanting to tell Parliament how to rule when it's elected you to be members of Parliament. Tomorrow they're going to tell us that black or white, they're going to go back there and say predominantly we see the administration to be too much black, we now need this, write the laws that are governing that. So there are definitions that must not be allowed to find themselves on the back door, which may oppose the spirit of the constitutional democracy we are under, and that those definitions must find expression and be led to then be expressed where it's necessary. When the person talks about pluralism, we will talk about pluralism in the comment and not define pluralism on the basis of analysis of who are the chairpersons of that board. If the necessity, like the Honourable Member said, is to have inclusion of political parties who are in Parliament, let it be there. Let them be accused of pluralism and after that the issue necessary would be proper representation and having at least a necessary representation of political parties that are in Parliament. My view is that too much of these prescriptions, which goes to different laws like this one, may necessarily be in contradiction with the lines of because these are this prescription of fit and proper. It has been adopted. It can't be yet. Everybody who applies is assumed first to be qualified to the advert. How does that a person who does not qualify get shortlisted? It's a criminal act on people who are involved there. To then prescribe is to confine Parliament and its committees into the National Council of Provinces to feelings of individuals necessary. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, for your input. Honorable Motla Shupik.
No, Chair, thanks. You know, Chair, I don't want to repeat what the fellow honorable members have said. Part of them have covered me, but on a lighter note, Chair, you know, we are living in a democratic society and where the majority rules. And many people, even today, shout aloud about what will happen in 2019, that they will be governing. Perhaps they will have four chairpersons because they will be in government. It is on a lighter note. But what I want to say, we don't legalize to address a particular situation. Address it in the manner that it accommodates. We legalize for sustainability and to bring better service delivery to our people. Now, in this instance, there's no harm here in having the advisory board constituted as it is because of the current situation, because we are not addressing the current situation. We're addressing a sustainable legal situation that will last for some years. Now, Chair, the only thing that I wanted to ask Advocate Jenkins relates to the advisory board. We are a committee, the four committees of finance, and then the four chairpersons are in the advisory board. Is it, do I read it to be they are delegated executive powers and the entire committee is part of the board without executive powers? Because I want to understand, and because it's purely for administrative purposes, administering a particular situation, which is here the appointment of the director. Now, what is the process, if you can simply explain to me, in terms of the appointment? Does it get finalized, or it is presented before the committee? That it's just a process issue, so that it gets clarified and I don't get confused.
I think that point is very important. Dealing with this question about whether the advisory board, as it's constituted now, is appropriate or not. Because when it comes to the appointment of the director, we have the four committees making a recommendation to the two houses. And that's why it's an open and transparent process. So at that level, we have a committee participating with an open and transparent process. When we get to the role of the advisory board, much more limited role. I mean, I would borrow the words of the chairperson and say it's an administrative role. We're looking at the conditions of service. We're looking at the structure. Why we have the four chairpersons of the committees there is because these are the four committees that do deal with the process set out in the legislation. So they are in a position to say, well, we're not getting the service we require. We want more deputy directors, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not written here, but I would argue certainly that, as with any other committee, the committee chairperson is accountable to the committee. If that committee chairperson wants to send letters or mandates or discuss issues with other committees and deal with programming, you have to bring it back to the committee. Chair, I hope I'm not stepping on your toes. But you have to bring it back to the committee to say, this is where we're going. I mean, by providing leadership, but also by then getting input from the committee. So when it comes to fulfilling the function of the advisory board, if the chairperson is ignoring the demands of the committee, I mean, there will be inefficiencies, that's, for lack of a better word. I mean, there will be problems. So I would, in short, say that the chairperson won't have executive powers, they have administrative powers to deal in, administrative powers. So they're not going to take, they must take these decisions in consultation with the director to say, okay, this is the structure we want, this is what we think is appropriate for their conditions of service, their leave, etc., etc. And, I mean, if that, those decisions taken at the board level with the director turns out to hamstring the operations of the PBO, certainly that chairperson or chairpersons of all those committees need to listen to his members and saying, we're not getting what we want from the PBO. We're not getting proper briefings. We don't have the intellectual capacity to actually take on National Treasury about the fiscal framework or issues of how revenue is distributed and so forth. So that's the kind of discussion I imagine will happen if things are not happening. So there will be accountability from the board members to the committees. But it's not, I mean, in the end, the director, after getting this discussion and consultations, he will be responsible to account to the houses through the executive authority on the operations. And that's the director's responsibility. The executive authority will remain with the houses, which is delegated to the speaker and the chairperson. Sir, if I...
Yes, yes, sir.
If I can move on. Yeah. The next issue, the insertion subsection 17 and 18 at the bottom of page 13. Yes, page 13, at the bottom of page 13 from lines 46 onwards. This is your information gathering provisions. So what we're saying there is the PBO, and apparently they've had problems with getting timeous relevant information to do their function or to fulfill their function. So you're writing in here now that the PBO may obtain information it requires for the performance of its functions from any organ of state or person the PBO considers appropriate. So it can include the public sphere and it can include the private sphere. So the PBO has legislative power to go and ask for this information. In the case where they get the information from a government-funded institution, whether it's a department like Treasury or whether it's an entity, that information must be provided free of charge, because government is already funding that institution. So PBO doesn't have to pay. I suppose if you're going to get the other side of that coin, is you want information from auditing firms, which are private entities, they might say, well, it's going to cost us money to get this to you in whatever format you want, so we're going to charge you for that. And we have included there, like, of course, some information is protected. So the PBO will have to take account of that. You can't ask any information. That information is protected by law, whether confidential information like taxpayers' information. PBO won't have access to that. Chairperson, if we page over to page 14, we're dealing with the last bits of the Act now, norms and standards for provincial legislatures. The way the Principal Act is drafted is that it's very per entry. If the provincial legislature, in terms of section, I think it's 120, subsection 3 of the Constitution, wants to pass its own money bills amendment procedure, the norms and standards set out presently in the Principal Act is peremptory, the provincial legislature must follow that norms and standards. However, the Constitution gives that power to the provincial legislature, not to Parliament. And we can compare that to powers and privileges. Powers and privileges of legislatures, that function has been given to Parliament to determine powers and privileges, and not to provincial legislatures. But this one is specific in the Constitution, 120 sub 3. So what we're doing with norms and standards is removing all those per entry provisions, removing all the ideas or concepts that says you must adhere to. And that's why if we look at line 4 on page 14, it says, provincial legislatures must not adhere to, but take into account the norms and standards. So it's been discretionary. Clause 15 brings in a new provision in the Act 16, capital A. It just empowers the executive authority to make regulations. I spoke about that earlier. Clause 16 includes amendments to section 17 of the Act. Instead of calling it the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, we're going to call it the Money Bills and Related Matters Act. We're changing the date from 2008 to 2009 because that was an omission in the Principal Act. We're making it the 2009 Act. And then the schedule itself we amend in two ways. Number one, again, we're taking away the peremptory provision to say it must provide for. We're saying now it must take into account. And then we set out the principles that must be taken into account. when a provincial legislature wants to draft its own provincial money bills amendment procedure. In that regard, we again change interest costs to servicing charges. I spoke about that earlier. It's a wider concept when it gets to debt levels. And then, Chair, the amendments, or the substantive amendment, is we're taking out, on page 15, paragraph E and F of the schedule, which basically, E and F, all that bold printed words we're taking out, because that is basically telling a committee of a legislature how it should report and what should be in the report. And that is the function of a provincial legislature, not of parliament. So we're removing that. And then, as I said at the beginning of my presentation, on page 16, we amending the long title of the Money Bills and Related Matters Act, if I can call it a new name. And we're including certain areas there. We say to provide a procedure to amend money bills and the division of revenue bill, because the division of revenue bill is not a money bill, and related fiscal instruments, in other words, referring to the fiscal framework and the MTBPS, to represent the interests of the people on public finances. In that way, we are trying to emphasize, again, the patriotic nature of the exercise of the budget, and to ensure public participation in the budget process, same purpose, and to provide for matters connected therewith. Sure, that is the legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Advocate Jenkins. Yes. This clause by clause exercise was very necessary. Are there any questions on this last part referring to the legislators, provincial legislators, that you want to put a question on to Advocate Jenkins? Covered? Thank you. Honourable members, that concludes the briefing. We will now head for the hearing that starts at 2 o'clock. The same venue. That we stay here. If no one turns up, then we adjourn. There is a 4 o'clock meeting of the ad hoc committee dealing with the Northwest intervention. Referring to the committee program, I just requested the secretary to circulate again the finance part, the finance program, select committee finance for the fourth term. The main activity will be the MTBBS. What we will also be dealing with, honorable members, in terms of the select committee for finance, is all the tax laws amendment bills. There's three. The monetary rights amounts amendment bill, the tax laws administration amendment bill, and then the tax laws amendment bill. It's three. The select committee, or the standing committee on finance, is having their last meeting on the 13th of November. But there's no clarity that it will be the last meeting on the legislation. Because I engaged with the chair of the standing committee, Honorable Green. Then it must be voted on in committee and then go to the plenary in the National Assembly and then referred to us. So provisional dates was this morning submitted to the WIPS meeting, where we hope this legislation can be referred to us more speedily. That we conclude that process on the bills on the 30th of November. But there's a big question mark, when is it going to be referred to us? And you will remember my words before we adjourned in September. Make provision for another week. That is the reason, the referral. So I'm just giving you the reality what we are facing. Thank you, honorable members. What is the lunch arrangement? Can we get some indication? Father? But someone must inform us. Where is the committee assistant? No, she can't be out there. They must be inside. Please call the lady. That's what I don't understand. Then I'm away. Nosipo, what is the lunch arrangement?
There's been a lunch, but it's not enough.
Sorry, I can't hear you.
There's been a lunch on site, but it's not enough for everybody.
Will you direct the members outside to just show them? Thank you. Members, we meet together at 2 o'clock. Same venue. Thank you. I just want to talk about my